Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Murder of Robert Warren. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'm your host for tonight. Hey everyone, in this episode, we are going to talk about a mystery that has remained an enigma for the last 19 years. We are going to discuss a true crime case that raises more questions the more you look into it. Whilst initially the answers seem somewhat apparent and obvious, not all is as it appears to be. Back on August the 2nd, 2006, emergency services received a frantic 911 call. The call was placed at around 11:50 p.m. The call came in from a gentleman located at a townhouse on Swan Street in Washington DC's DuPont Circle neighborhood, an affluent, trendy, and historic part of the city. What would begin is one of the most baffling, disturbing, and controversial murder mysteries in United States history. But one that is rarely discussed today, only 2 decades after the fact. This is the story of the murder of Robert Warren. Now, as I previously stated, you may be tempted to assume that on the surface, and for the most part, this case seems pretty cut and dry. Straightforward in its outcome, perhaps. But look closer. And tonight, we are going to do just that. The victim, the police investigation, the suspects, and the interviews. Let's dig into it all. Because in this case, I don't think that any theory put forward by law enforcement or lawyers on either side of the judicial wall, so to speak, really makes any sense. Firstly, to give you an overview of the crime itself. On August the 2nd, 2006, 32-year-old Washington, D.C.-based attorney Robert E. Warren was murdered at 1509 Swan Street. Warren was fatally stabbed while staying overnight at a friend's townhouse in the DuPont Circle neighborhood. The home where the crime occurred was owned by partners Joe Price and Victor Zaborski. They shared their home with a third man by the name of Dylan Ward, where the three lived together in a polyamorous relationship. Robert Warren, who had been married to his wife Catherine Ellen for just over 3 years, had decided to stay the night at the Swan Street residence upon invitation by his friend Price. Warren had gone to the Swan Street house at around 10:30 p.m. from work. He was working late that night, but that wasn't his usual practice. He had planned to stay at the Price Zaborski Ward residence several days in advance. Neighbors in the DuPont Circle Street, which is a popular LGBTQ+ area of Washington, reported hearing a scream that several corroborated as happening between 11 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. Several witnesses all stated that it happened during the 11 p.m. news programming. Law enforcement would later identify the scream as being that of Victor Zaborski. At precisely 11:49 p.m., Zaborski made a 911 call and an emergency medical team arrived at the scene just 5 minutes later. Officers of the Metropolitan Police Department, the MPDC, would arrive at the scene just 3 minutes after this. Joe Price called Robert Warren's wife, Kathleen, to inform her that her husband had been stabbed, with Robert being pronounced dead at George Washington's University Hospital at 12:24 a.m. in the early hours of August 3rd. Joe Price, Dylan Ward, and Victor Zaborski each denied any involvement in Robert Warren's death. They all postulated that an intruder had entered the house and murdered Robert. And to this day, the murderer remains at large and unidentified. Okay, so that's a very basic overview of the crime. I can understand if you have already arrived at your own conclusions, shall we say, as to what may have happened. On the surface, everything seems fairly obvious here, right? After all, Occam's razor tells us that, quote, "the simplest explanation for a phenomenon is usually the correct one." But there's more to this. Let's take a look at the victim, Robert Wan. Who was he? Well, Robert Wan was a very interesting person. He was a very successful, and by all accounts from those who knew him, he was happy, honest, and carefree. He was known amongst friends and family to be nice, quiet, and a decent, upstanding person. Robert worked in the field of law. Although his role was stressful, the pressure and stress of the role was something which Robert thrived on and made him perform to his best. Born Robert Eric Wan on June 1, 1974 in Manhattan, he grew up in the Brooklyn district of New York City. Robert was fourth-generation Chinese-American and an only child of William and Amy Wan. His early years were spent surrounded by extended family in Chinatown, Manhattan, before his family headed to Brooklyn. Robert attended Xaverian High School, a private Catholic school in Brooklyn, where he graduated as valedictorian of his class. Following this, he attended the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, as a James Monroe Scholar. During his formative years, Robert would write essays about what it meant to be an Asian American in this day and age. Whilst Robert didn't speak any of the Chinese languages, he was extremely proud of his background and heritage. It was something that really meant a lot to him. Whilst at William and Mary College, Robert was studying public policy and civil rights, and these were subjects that Robert took very seriously. He was the kind of guy to go on marches, protests, and to fight for civil liberties within the United States. His friend group reflected this, and his strong felt views and values, with close friends from multiple ethnic, religious, and sexuality-based backgrounds. Whilst Robert considered himself a heterosexual Chinese-American male, he held no prejudices and was known to be extremely open-minded and accepting of others. Whilst attending William and Mary College, Robert met Joseph Price, who was then a senior student. This was during the 1992-93 academic year. Wan and Price would share several activities together, and thus would become fast friends. They were each members of the Golden Key Honor Society, and also took part in the Student Government Leadership Program. Robert was also elected to the Omicron Delta Kappa Mortar Board, an elected board of a college fraternity. They were also both members of a secret society called, quote-unquote, 13. Whilst this sounds fairly dark and nefarious, it was actually quite the opposite. Members of 13 went around campus doing anonymous good deeds, making anonymous donations, and giving anonymous gifts, promoting positivity for little or no personal gain. Price graduated in 1993, a few years ahead of Wan. Wan would go on to graduate from William and Mary in 1996. He was active in college with various clubs, groups, and fraternities, and when he graduated, he received the prestigious Elgin and Sidney Sullivan Award. Robert then continued on to receive a degree with honors from the University of Pennsylvania Law School in 1999. His degree was a Juris Doctor degree, a professional law degree which is issued within the United States, United Kingdom, and Commonwealth nations. Whilst at the University of Pennsylvania, Robert served as the editor of the school's law journal. And shortly after graduating, Robert went on to pass the state bar exam in New York City. Robert would subsequently serve as federal district court law clerk to Judge Raymond A. Jackson for the Eastern District of Virginia. He later began his law career by working in the field of commercial real estate law as an attorney with the Washington, D.C.-based law firm Covington and Burling, a role he would practice for a period of 6 years. Covington and Burling is a really prestigious law firm. It was while working here that Robert met and became good friends with Eric H. Holder, future Attorney General of the United States. Robert was drawn to work at Covington & Burling in part because of the opportunity he would have to promote pro bono legal services to those in need. As part of his public service responsibilities with the company, he also served as general counsel for the Organization of Chinese Americans, or the OCA. Robert was 2 years into his career in 2002 when he attended a conference in Chicago, Illinois. And it was at that conference where he would meet his future wife. She also worked in law and was based out of Chicago. They began a long-distance relationship, and they then married a year later in June 2003. Robert married Catherine Ellen Yu on June 7th in a Catholic ceremony. The couple would set up home in Fairfax County, Virginia. Robert Wan, as he had been throughout high school and his college years, was very active within the Asian American community in New York. He was also active in Washington, Philadelphia, and the greater Eastern Coast area. He supported organizations such as the Museum of Chinese in America and also the aforementioned OCA. Around 2 months before his untimely death, Robert left Covington & Burling and was hired with the Washington-based organization Radio Free Asia on June 30, 2006. Radio Free Asia, for clarity, is a non-profit news service that publishes online news, information, commentary, and broadcast radio programs for its audiences across Asia. The service ensures robust and factual independent reporting with a mission to, quote,
always provide accurate and uncensored reporting to countries in Asia that have poor media environments and limited protections for speech and press freedoms.
At Radio Free Asia, Robert worked as general legal counsel for the organization. At the time of his death, Robert had just achieved the elected position of president of the Asian Pacific American Bar Association, a position that he had not yet begun to serve on when he died. This is Robert's background, which leads us onto the night of the crime, August 2nd, 2006. On that evening, Robert was working late. He hadn't long been working in his job at Radio Free Asia. He wanted to work later that night as an opportunity to meet the night shift staff. Robert was keen to introduce himself to them and get to know them. In addition to this, his wife Catherine had an early start the following day, so Robert didn't want to be arriving home late after a long subway commute and disturb her. With this in mind, he spoke to Joe Price, an old friend, and arranged to stay at his place for the night. They hadn't seen each other for a while, so it would be a great opportunity to catch up, they thought. The two men had arranged this around about a week before. It was ideal, Robert thought, as his friend Joe lived less than 10 minutes away from the offices of Radio Free Asia. You'll recall that Robert and Joe had met back in college, and they had remained close friends over the years since. They regularly hung out, although hadn't seen each other in quite a while at this point. Robert and Joe celebrated birthdays and other big occasions together, and Robert had been to Joe Price's house many times, although had never stayed the night. But Robert was comfortable there, and he was also comfortable around Joe's partners, Victor and Dylan. Robert's wife, Catherine, also knew Joe very well, and she was more than happy that Robert had a place to crash so close to his office. Anyway, this menage a trois situation with Victor, Joe and Dylan, well, as it transpired, the three men had quite kinky and extreme sexual tastes, shall we say. Think gimp masks, leather, whips, chains, dildos and all that kind of stuff. Dylan was very much a dom, whilst Joe was a sub, if you know what I mean. Now, to be clear, Robert was not involved in any of these interests of theirs. Robert was completely heterosexual. He was simply old friends with Joe and needed a place to stay. The reason I raise the sexual tastes and proclivities of these men will become important later, but for now, I'll just put a pin in this. The house that Joe, Dylan and Victor lived in was a stunning piece of architecture and property. It was worth over $1 million back then in 2006. It's likely almost three times that in value now. As I stated, it was a historic townhouse, three stories, an island kitchen, spacious living room on the first floor and another on the ground floor. On the second floor was a large master bedroom and an office, which also doubled as a guest room overlooking the street. There was a second bedroom on the second floor too. Additionally, there was another bedroom on the third floor. Beneath the house, there was also a separate basement apartment that the three would rent out to a female friend of theirs named Sarah. Robert arrived at the house shortly after 10:30 p.m. When he arrived, he greeted Joe and Dylan and had a glass of water with them in the kitchen. Victor was already in bed on the third floor at this point. Robert, Joe and Dylan spent a short while chatting, but Robert was keen to take a shower and get into bed. He had had a long day and was pretty tired. Robert was assigned Joseph's office on the second floor to sleep in, which, as I said, doubled as a guest bedroom and had a pull-out sofa bed. Dylan also had a bedroom on the second floor situated across the hall from the guest bedroom Robert was staying in. Victor and Joe slept in the bedroom directly above. What happened next is where things become slightly muddied. Joseph and Victor would tell law enforcement that they were in bed shortly after saying goodnight to Robert, and they were on the verge of drifting off to sleep when they heard the door chime. There wasn't an alarm on the house, but every time the front door would open, a chime would ring out throughout the house. The two men assumed that it was their friend Sarah who was renting the basement flat coming home, so they didn't give the chime a second thought. But shortly after that chime, Joe and Victor stated that they heard three grunts. They thought this sounded strange, so they decided to get up and check out what was going on. So the couple headed down to the second floor, from their bedroom on the third. Robert's bedroom would have been to the right at the bottom of the stairs. The door to his room was wide open, they said. Robert was in there, lying on his back, facing straight up on the bed. He had been stabbed multiple times. They could tell right away that he was dead. The two men were stunned and stood staring at him in horror. They had only seen him alive less than 30 minutes prior. Then, from the room across the hall, Dylan emerged in the process of waking up and asked what was going on. Remember that the men had stated that they had heard the door chime before they heard the three grunts. Then they went downstairs. The men said that they never heard the door chime again, which would indicate that whoever came in didn't go back out, at least not through the front door. They also told police that they didn't hear footsteps at any point. They didn't see anybody, and they didn't witness anything happening at all. Then Victor immediately called the police. Here is his 911 call.
DC Emergency 911, Operator 6752. Do you need police, fire, or ambulance?
I'm in an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
We had someone that was in our house, evidently, and they stabbed somebody.
Okay, somebody's inside the house now?
I don't know. We heard.
Are they bleeding? You see someone bleeding?
Someone is bleeding in our house.
Okay, where's they bleeding from?
I think in the stomach.
The stomach, is he cautious? Calm down for me. I'm going to send some help, okay? Female or male?
It's a male. He's a friend of ours. He's spending the night with us.
Okay, and who was the person that stabbed him? Do you know? Is he cautious?
We need an ambulance.
Ma'am, listen to me.
He's not conscious.
He's not conscious at all?
No. We need someone right now.
Is he breathing? Listen to me. Calm down. I'm going to help you, okay? Is he breathing?
I'm upstairs. And he's downstairs. I don't know.
Okay, who's downstairs with him?
My partner is downstairs with him right now. He told me to go upstairs and call the police immediately.
Okay, who's the person that stabbed him?
I don't know. We think it's somebody with an intruder in the house. We heard the chime at the door.
The person that stabbed him, is he still in the home?
I don't know.
Apply pressure to that area. If he was wherever he was stabbed at on his body, and then you take a towel downstairs while you're waiting for the paramedics to arrive, and just apply pressure.
My partner's holding the The person had one of our knives.
The person that stabbed him ran out the door with a knife?
I think.
This call was made at 11:49 p.m., with emergency services arriving about 5 minutes later. And this is when things start to get weird. When the two paramedics arrived, they entered the house and asked who needed the help. The paramedics later commented that Joe, Victor and Dylan were all acting extremely suspicious and kind of cagey. The three men would barely speak to the paramedics. The emergency medical staff would also say that as soon as they set foot inside the house, they knew straight away that something was off about the whole scene. The hairs on the back of their neck stood up. They knew something very disturbing had just happened there. Joe Price was the only person in the room where Robert's body was situated. When the paramedics arrived, he had his back turned to them the whole time when they were there. Joe stepped away from Robert's body when the medical team entered the room, but still kept his back to them the entire time. The medics had never experienced anything like this before, and both men were extremely experienced at their jobs, one being a 10-year employee and the other being a 15-year employee within the service. By this point, everybody was acting weird, and in a quote from one of the paramedics, the three men were behaving in a quote, disturbing manner. The paramedics were so on edge when they were trying to treat Robert that they commented that they were afraid to take their eyes off the men in case one of them would attack them. The paramedics were eerily terrified. To add further bizarre elements to the scene, the paramedics commented that it was clear that the three men had all just freshly showered. Their hair was still wet and slicked back. They were each wearing bathrobes, and one was holding a wet towel. The first thing the paramedics noticed was the injuries to Robert. There were three large holes in his chest, they later commented in witness statements they gave to law enforcement. Now, the room was decorated entirely white. White painted walls and bookshelves, white bedsheets and white furniture. But there was also no blood. There was no blood on Robert's body, and there was no blood anywhere else in the bedroom. There was no blood on the white bed either. There were three wounds to Robert's chest, but there was no blood coming from the wounds. In fact, the paramedics would comment on how neat and tidy the room was. It was pristinely clean. It was almost like Robert had just been lying on the bed and three holes had just appeared in his chest without any blood emerging. Very strange, and an entirely unique crime scene. Robert's wallet and his BlackBerry telephone were sat on the bedside table beside him. The paramedics told law enforcement that upon closer inspection, it appeared that Robert had been stabbed in the chest three times, then he had been undressed post-mortem, showered, cleaned, redressed, and his body being placed back on the bed. Robert was known to grind his teeth when he slept. So each night, he would sleep with a gum shield in his mouth. Well, this gum shield was still in his mouth. The murder weapon was left on the bedside table next to his wallet and phone. It was a large butcher's knife that was from the home itself. It had come from the kitchen. It was later identified when police moved Robert's body that there were a few small droplets of blood on the bed underneath his body. But these droplets were tiny. Small specks, if you will. On the floor next to the bed, there was a damp towel that also had some droplets of blood on it. The paramedics assumed that this was the towel that Joe had used to put pressure on Robert's wounds before the paramedics arrived. But the amount of blood was tiny, and nowhere near the amount that there should have been from three horrific stab wounds, such as these. But no, it was later identified that the blood on the towel was actually from where someone had used it to wipe a knife clean. But the knife itself still had blood the entirety of the length of the blade. Something else that was noted as being strange was that the three wounds inflicted on Robert were measured as being roughly 4 inches deep. But the blood on the knife was up to 6 inches deep. So by all accounts it appeared that the knife next to Robert's body was too long to have been used in the stabbing of Robert. The knife was later found to contain fibers from the towel that was found next to the bed, which confirmed that it had been used to wipe the knife. Although, if it had wiped the knife, why was there still blood all over the knife blade? Robert was wearing a t-shirt at the time of his death. The t-shirt had holes in it that were consistent with the stab wounds to Robert's chest beneath it. So the assumption would be that Robert was wearing the t-shirt when he was stabbed. But, and this is a pretty big but, there was no blood on the t-shirt. There was also no fibers from the t-shirt found on the knife. It seemed as though the knife on the bedside table wasn't actually the murder weapon, and that it was just made to look like it was the murder weapon. So before I get deeper into the men who were in that house, their backgrounds, and what they say happened in their police interviews, so let me get into exactly what happened to Robert Wan, because it is traumatic. So as I stated, there were three stab wounds to Robert's chest. The medical examiner would say that the wounds were perfect, almost as if Robert did not try to fight off his attacker. There was no tearing of the wounds or defense wounds on his arms or hands. Each of the knife wounds were directed from the exact same angle too, each of them slicing through significant blood vessels, organs and arteries. Blood should have been pumping from those wounds. With the added adrenaline going through Robert's body, as would happen during an attack, there should have been pints of blood all over his body, the bed, the walls and the floor. So the scene was very, very strange. None of the knife wounds would have killed Robert instantly. He would have bled out slowly in order to die from them. Robert would have been alive for a considerable amount of time after he had been stabbed. But there were no signs of that happening. The medical examiner knew Robert would have been alive after he had been stabbed because there was blood found in his intestines, thus his heart was still pumping post-stabbing. The medical examiner and the police agreed that it appeared as if Robert had been paralyzed before being stabbed. There were burst blood vessels in Robert's eyes, which indicated a possible strangulation, but there was no ligature marks or bruising around his neck. The medical examiner suggested that maybe somebody had held a pillow over his head. Robert also had multiple needle puncture wounds on his body. They were found in his neck, in his feet, and in his chest. This indicated that Robert may have been injected with something. Robert's wife Catherine was asked if Robert had been recently undergoing any kind of medical procedures, which would explain the needle punctures. But she would say no. Robert had no procedures, nor had even been to a doctor for a very long time. Needle marks don't last that long, 1 or 2 days maximum. So, law enforcement was certain that Robert had acquired the punctures within the previous 24 hours. The examiner ran a series of toxicology tests on Robert to identify any foreign substances in his body. He expected to find some kind of paralyzing agent or illicit drugs. But there was nothing. The toxicology came back showing nothing unusual. GHB, benzos, methamphetamine, opiates, none were identified. The timing of the toxicology meant that any drugs would not have likely broken down in Robert's system to allow non-detection. But it is entirely possible, however, that a drug was used that the toxicology didn't pick up or recognize. I will say this is entirely speculation, however. The medical examiner also conducted a rape kit on Robert's body. This included a forensic examination of Robert's penis and anus and the surrounding areas of his body. Law enforcement suspected there may have been sexual assault involved in the crime. Jackpot. The medical examiner identified semen inside Robert's anus. So the examiner tested the semen's DNA code. The semen was Robert's. So it was as if Robert had sexually assaulted himself. There was no doubt to the medical examiner and investigating officers that Robert had arrived at this house, been incapacitated, and then been tortured to death. But they couldn't work out how. The wounds Robert suffered would have been extremely painful, there's no doubt. It was almost like a ritualistic killing. He had definitely bled a lot, but there was next to no blood in the room where he was found. In addition, the way the guys who owned the house were acting was incredibly suspicious. So, who were these three men? Let's take a look at Joe, Victor, and Dylan. Each of the stories of what happened that night, which they gave to law enforcement, essentially and for the most part, matched perfectly. They were identical. First up was Joseph Price. When the police began speaking with him, Joe Price was very eager to speak for all three of the men. It's important to know at this juncture that Joe Price was a lawyer, a very successful lawyer. So it would make sense as to why he would want to be the one who would want to speak on behalf of the group. He maintained, just as Victor had done on his initial 911 call, that an intruder must have come into the house and done this terrible act to Robert. All three of the men were separated by law enforcement and interviewed separately. Now, to be clear, they were not arrested or detained. They were all free to leave at any time during the police interviews, but they each stayed and spoke freely. Now, Joseph Price was Robert's old friend from college. He was 35 years old at the time of the crime. He was an attorney with Arndt Fox Schiff LLP, a law firm in Washington, D.C. He made partner in 2006, the same year that all this occurred. So as I said before, he was very successful. He specialized in trademark and copyright law and had represented a number of major clients. And he was also pretty active within gay rights advocacy. Here is Joe from his police interview.
Fingerprinting that knife, I mean, somebody jumped our fence and went through that door. You said, tell you what I know. We have an alarm system. Was the alarm was not on, but it has a function where the doors chime if you open the doors or the alarm. After Robert was there, we had drinks around the sink. Went upstairs, we showed Robert where the shower was, where the bathroom was, right down the hall. Here's your bed. We'd already made out the pull-out bed for him. We said goodnight. He said he was going to take a shower then. It was all sticky. I went upstairs, saw the last 5 minutes of the show, and then started watching the first 10 minutes of, some other thing on Spike TV, and I knew Victor was getting annoyed that I wasn't turning off the TV, so I turned it off, and we went to sleep. So Victor and I both jump out of bed, we run downstairs. There's, the stairs end at the door. I see the doors open, I see Robert is laying there. The bed cover is pulled back. He's laying there. There is blood on him. His hand was out, one arm was out like this, and one arm was like this, I think, or somewhere across his body. And there was a knife. I believe it was on his stomach or something like that. I picked up the knife, I moved it, I lifted up his shirt, and I could clearly see there was one, puncture wound right on his belly. I lifted up his shirt a little more. There was a lot of blood on his chest.
Is he homosexual?
No, not gay. Never has been. Didn't think about it. No drugs, no booze, nothing. Robert was the best, absolutely straight A, no nonsense guy I ever met. Like I said, I know Victor and Dylan better than I know my mother. There's no chance on the face of this earth that either one of them could, punch someone, never mind, kill someone. It's ridiculous. Yeah. You guys are focusing on us.
No, this did not happen. We focused on the facts.
I know. You guys have to do your jobs.
So all we can look at is what we know, we see.
So long as someone's dusting the back door and all that kind of stuff, I know you guys will find evidence. There was somebody else in our house. I know. I heard the chime.
Yeah. You heard the chime. Was that the person leaving?
No, I believe it was the person coming in, because then I hear the
renting
later.
You're not sure how much later.
I know I didn't fall back to sleep.
Wait, you heard the sound on the door.
Somebody comes in.
Did you hear a scream or anything like that?
No. No.
You heard no scream.
I heard the chime, and it was quiet.
That's it.
Yeah. I don't know how long. Maybe it was a minute, two, three, four. I just woke up. I'm thinking, oh, Sarah came home, and you know, I roll back over.
Your floors, the stairs, they're hardwood, right? So you would think that if somebody was going down the stairs, even if somebody was running down the stairs, you may hear that, right?
This is one of my oldest friends. What on earth would possess me to do such a thing? Never mind, could I do it? It's crazy.
The whole thing is crazy.
Yeah.
The guy ain't supposed to be staying over at your house tonight. That's crazy. That doesn't make any sense.
But just ask his wife if he was planning to. I can show you the emails right here, probably. I mean, I got my BlackBerry. This is from my work account.
Well, maybe he's thinking about doing a little experimentation. I don't know.
You know,
why not?
If that were true, I would tell you guys.
Why would you?
Because
why?
Because why not tell you? I mean, my God, I want you to find who did this.
So what I'm asking you is, where'd this guy go?
I believe he ran out of the house.
Between the grunting and you running down the stairs, which happened like...
Yeah. Wow, yes.
That's fast.
I agree with you. Look, it's a crazy... I mean, why wasn't the back door wide open? Why wasn't the gate wide open? Why didn't he go out the front door?
Yeah, but you would think that you were running to this guy, or you would see this guy running.
Yeah, maybe.
Because you said seconds.
Yeah. I mean, it really was...
That minute, seconds.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Did you hear anybody running downstairs or anything? Mm-hmm.
I did.
So what makes you think it's a burglary if you didn't hear anybody running?
It's he knows in his heart. Couldn't be Dylan.
I know, you guys don't know it's from Adam, so who knows? You know, we could all be crazy as lumps, but, you know, all I can tell you is it wasn't one of them. It wasn't me. We have no reason on earth to do this. I mean... I know Robert's whole family. I mean,
I got three homosexuals in a house, mm-hmm. and I got one straight guy. What's he doing over there? What is he doing over there? I think we're all drinking wine. You know what's going to happen tonight? You're coming to Jesus tonight. That's what's going
that's
on.
That's fascinating and insulting.
Here we go. That's why you made me say it.
But you know what? That's not what happened. Robert's happily married. I do know that.
No, why are you, but Dylan's not happily married, is he?
Yeah, he is.
Oh, to you?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why you're upstairs with Victor.
Yeah.
And he's downstairs with Robert.
He wasn't down there with Robert.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, come on.
You don't know what you're talking about.
I do know.
No, you don't, because you're upstairs and you can't sing.
I can't.
You wanna. But you don't know.
That's just not even possible. We didn't do it. I found Robert laying on my couch. It is as bizarre to me as if I found a hippo in my house. It is absolutely unbelievable.
As you could hear from Joe's statement, he says that him and Victor were falling asleep. They heard the door chime, then they heard some grunts. They went down the stairs to investigate, and then they found Robert. He said that he found the knife on Robert's chest, picked it up, accidentally getting his own fingerprints on it, then left it on the bedside table. He would later change this version of events, however. He later said that he pulled the knife out of Robert's chest and then left it on the bedside table. If you were in Joe's position here, do you think that you would remember the difference between picking up a knife off someone's chest and pulling a knife out of someone's chest? I appreciate shock and trauma could play a part here. Anyway, we then hear Joe say that he raised Robert's t-shirt to look at his wounds, and at this point, he saw Dylan come out from his bedroom at the end of the hallway. So another pause for thought here. Joe and Victor, who were both upstairs, had heard the chime and grunts and come down to investigate, thus finding Robert. But Dylan, who was much, much closer, didn't come out of his bedroom to see what was going on. Strange? I'll let you guys decide that one. Joseph said that he got a towel and applied pressure to Robert's wounds. As I mentioned, this didn't match the blood that was found on the towel. Joe also said the front door was locked, but the back door had been left unlocked. So this could be how the mystery intruder got in. Joe was pretty insistent that the police dust for prints on the back door just seconds before he reaffirmed that he felt the intruder came in the front door. They heard the front door chime as it opened, remember? Strange again, no? Joe added that there was zero chance that Dylan and Victor would ever hurt anyone. During Joe's interview, he seemed very concerned about Dylan. He asked to see him several times and asked if he had been let out. He was noticeably less concerned with his partner Victor, however. Now, Victor Zaborski was Joseph's life partner. They had been together for over a decade by this point. Victor worked in marketing. He was a senior level marketing executive. Again, he was hugely successful in his career. He supposedly worked on the now famous United States Got Milk campaign that was created by Goodby, Silverstein & Partners in the 90s, and I think still runs today. It certainly did back in February when I was last over in the States. Anyway, here is Victor Zaborski's interview.
So, what you're basically telling me, and we went over this earlier, is somebody came in your house. What you believe, somebody came in your house,
yes,
through your back door. Well, first of all, over your fence, over your high fence. How high is that? 8 feet? Higher?
Probably 9 feet.
Okay, 9 foot wood fence in the back. In through your back door, took a knife out of your butcher's block off the counter in your kitchen, went up to the second floor, and stabbed Robert, and left the knife there, then left, without taking anything, without anybody seeing anyone.
That's what I think happened. I think it was probably they were coming in to rob us. And
why didn't they take anything then if they were coming in to rob you? Why didn't they go to that first bedroom?
And I don't know.
Let me ask you this. Did Dylan kill Robert?
No.
How do you know that?
I know Dylan. He's not a violent person. He's one of the nicest, sweetest people I've ever met.
Did you kill him?
Yeah.
You didn't kill him?
No, I did not kill him.
No reason to?
No reason to kill him.
What about Paul?
Jeff.
I'm sorry, what about Joseph?
Absolutely not, he was with me.
That's quite a mystery we got working here. This is a good one. I mean, you know, four guys in the house, one guy ends up dead, the other three, you know, I'm saying I didn't do it, and the other person just didn't do it. But then we have no evidence of any type of forced entry, or anything like that.
That woke me was like a breathy kind of, but it was loud. I mean, and so I jumped up, Joe jumped up beside me. We're both sort of, what is that? What is that? We run to the door of our bedroom and open the door, and we heard another kind of grunt, and flip the switch on in the hallway, and we both start running down the stairs, and Joe was just in front of me. And then we got to the doorway of the office and saw Robert laying on the bed, and I just freaked out. His eyes were rolled back. He looked very pale.
Whatever happened between the people in that house. Nobody broke into that house. That didn't happen. We know that for sure. Now, there's one person that's going to be guilty of murder for stabbing Robert. Anybody that tries to cover up for him is going to be just as guilty and charged just as if they stabbed him. You're shaking your head, but I'm telling you, that's absolute truth. That's what's going to happen.
A friend of ours died tonight.
A friend of yours was murdered tonight. He didn't die. He didn't just die. He was murdered. Somebody stabbed him with a knife from that kitchen. And you know who that someone was.
I do not.
Yes, you do.
I do.
Yes, you do.
I do not.
Yes, you do. You certainly do know.
I do not.
You do know. And the further down the road you go with this, the worse it's going to be. Absolutely nobody broke in that house. One of you in that house killed him. Yes. One of you killed him. Maybe you. One of you killed him.
So, yeah, Victor's statement to the police was interesting, to say the least. He says that he wasn't supposed to be in the house that night. He'd been on a business trip and had come home early from that trip. He didn't meet Robert that night. He'd gone to bed early as he was exhausted from travelling. But he was awoken by a low scream, or grunt. After this, the story pretty much matches Joe's story, except for Victor adding that as they were going downstairs to investigate the chime and grunts, they heard another scream. Joe didn't mention a scream in his version of events. Victor also added that they heard more grunts. Again, an element absent from Joe's version of events. Then they found Robert. Victor said that he didn't see or hear anyone running away or any doors slamming. At this point, he said that he became pretty hysterical and that Joe told him to go upstairs and call 911, thus leaving Joe and Dylan alone with the body. During Victor's interview, the police were fairly confident that if they kept probing, they would be able to break Victor. But despite pushing him pretty hard, Victor stuck to his story, and for all intents and purposes, he didn't break. Now, finally, we come to Dylan. He was seemingly an odd man out in this threesome relationship. Joe and Victor, as we know, were highly accomplished businessmen. Both had won awards in their respective careers. Dylan, however, not so much. He was the son of a medical doctor from Tacoma, Washington. He had four brothers and sisters. He studied foreign policy in college, then decided it wasn't for him, so he went to the Culinary Institute of America, hoping to train as a chef. Following that, he then travelled to Taiwan and wrote a number of Chinese language children's books. Some of the titles of those books are Victor the Happy Robot, The Rainbow World, and The Library of Dreams. I tried to track down a copy of these books, but they're only available in China and fairly pricey. Anyway, after this stint in Taiwan, Dylan then moved to Washington, D.C., rented the basement apartment from Joe and Victor before moving upstairs and entering into a relationship with the two men. At this point in 2006, Dylan was working as a massage therapist. So here's Dylan's police interview.
Hello. Sergeant Wagner, supervisor here, this is Detective Norris.
Good.
We're all in the squad working on this matter.
What's that? Troubled. What's that?
Very troubled.
Yes.
I have to be honest and fair with you. I don't believe we're getting the truth here.
Everyone keeps telling me that. I don't know why.
Well, big part. One or more of you three. Sad this year.
I don't believe that. I really can't believe that. If it's one of the other guys, I will be completely shocked.
This guy's perfectly straight. And he's gonna leave his wife for the night and come over to y'all's house.
Because he's
not perfectly straight. That's not something a straight guy would do.
He was working late. He was probably taking the metro, and he didn't want to go all the way back up to the
If there's some reason that it happened or whatever like that, and you know maybe one of the other guys did it and you're in on this.
I'm not in on anything. I was in bed. As far as I know, they were in bed too.
What do you think should happen to if it is one of your friends? What do you think should happen?
No, there should be a trial. I mean, there has to be an investigation and a trial to figure out what happened.
Okay. I just find it hard to believe that this guy, Ron, who never done this before, all of a sudden comes over to your house, sleeps over your house, and the night that he decides to sleep over your house, there's a burglary that comes in there and kills Ron.
Dylan would say that while he was in his room across the hall, he heard Robert take a shower, go into his room, and heard the latch lock on Robert's door. So Robert's door was locked, according to Dylan. Then he said he fell asleep. He then awoke to the sound of some commotion outside his room in the hall, and subsequently opened the door to see the scene in front of him. Dylan was questioned extensively, but for the most part, he would remain fairly silent throughout. As you can imagine, the police were suspicious of Dylan the most. So much so that they submitted him to a polygraph test. Amongst the questions Dylan was asked during the lie detection test were, quote, "Did you kill Robert?" and "Do you know who killed Robert?" Dylan failed the polygraph overall, and a particular spiking lying was detected in relation to both of these questions. Polygraph tests are not always reliable, however, and are certainly not admissible in court, so take that with a pinch of salt. So far, everything is pretty nonsensical. The police also spoke with a next-door neighbour on the night of the initial investigation. The next-door neighbour was in bed watching television in their room that shared a wall with Robert's bedroom. The neighbour stated that sometime between 11 and 11:30 p.m. they heard a scream coming from the room next door. You'll recall the 911 call wasn't made until 11:49 p.m. so the timeline is starting to fall apart here. The police also spoke to Sarah, the tenant who lived in the basement apartment, but she told police that she had been out all night that night, so the chime from the front door couldn't have been her. Police examined every single entry point to the house. The front entrance, the rear entrance, the rooftop, and an entrance that led directly into the basement apartment. None of the entry points had any signs of forced entry. Nothing was disturbed in the home either, and nothing was missing. With the exception of one thing. While the police were searching the house, they looked at Dylan's room, and they found a cutlery set containing large cooking knives. Well, one of the large knives from this set was missing. Fun fact, the missing knife was able to be measured from the box that it was held in, as the knives were in plastic molds. Well, the missing knife matched the wound depth on Robert's body, a much closer match than the knife that was found on the bedside table. The missing knife from the cutlery set was never found. The police also conducted a sweep of the house for drugs, but the only thing they found was a small amount of ecstasy in Dylan's bedroom. But in addition to the drugs, they also found an extensive collection of hardcore S&M sex toys. Included in this kinky collection was electroshock devices, stun guns, gas masks, chains and restraints, ball gags, devices to hold you open, recording equipment, and insertion devices. As I said, the collection was extensive. The police also brought a cadaver dog into the house, as the law enforcement still had no idea where Robert had been killed exactly. They were skeptical that it was on the bed where he was found, that's for sure. It just didn't seem like it could have happened in the room that he was staying in. But seemingly, nowhere else in the house either. The cadaver dog led to two particular locations. Two locations that the dog identified were linked to the smell of blood and death. It led to the lint trap of the washing machine. It also led to a drain in the back garden. The police dug up the drain. There was nothing. There was a hose nearby that looked like it had been used recently, the police investigators speculated. Now the police also conducted an in-depth luminol search of the house to try and find any blood spots. The police would spray the entire place down with luminol and utilized multiple UV lights to try and identify blood, and again, no positive results came back. But, and this is another fairly big but, the luminol they used wasn't exactly luminol. It was leucofluorescein, a synthetic replicant. A luminol similar substance, but unlike luminol, you could only use the leucofluorescein on flat surfaces, horizontal surfaces. But the police used it incorrectly. They sprayed the substance across almost every wall and vertical surface in the house. Surfaces known to have the opposite effect on blood DNA detection. On vertical surfaces, this substance essentially destroys traces of hemoglobin rather than detects it. So all three men were consistent in their stories, at least for the most part. And all three were essentially saying that the other two would never have done anything like this. But whilst their innocence was being vehemently asserted, it was clear that there was no evidence of an intruder whatsoever. An intruder angle also made no logical sense. The police examined the home for 3 weeks. They removed all the drains. They demolished walls, removed furniture. They microanalyzed the location floors. And they found no evidence. Then, weirdly, 3 months later, Michael Price, the brother of Joseph Price, was arrested for breaking into the house to steal items the night of the murder. $7,000 worth of electronics, to be specific. Michael was arrested for the burglary, but those charges were later dropped. But what's interesting about this small little footnote is that Michael, it transpires, had a key to the house. This was something Joe Price nor any of the other two men mentioned. So Michael would have been able to get in without forcing entry. Something worth noting, I feel. Also of interest here is that Michael was at the time studying at university. He was staying in dorms nearby and studying to be a phlebotomist, essentially a healthcare professional with particular expertise in drawing blood samples from patients, performing blood and DNA diagnostic tests, blood donations, and blood research. He exclusively had classes in the evenings and had a perfect attendance rate the entire time he was enrolled in university. He never missed a class, ever. With the exception of, you guessed it, the night of the murder. Michael said that that night he was visiting family, and the family supported this alibi. All three men, Joe, Victor and Dylan, strongly denied having any sexual relationship with Robert. And Robert's family have also described him as both very heterosexual and happily married. All three men would attend Robert's funeral. Joe Price actually served as a pallbearer. Robert's family didn't believe that any of these three men in the house that night had anything to do with Robert's death. Robert's wife Catherine firmly stood behind the three men and their version of events. She trusted them explicitly. In the months that followed, all three men moved to Florida, Miami-Dade County to be specific. It seemed like they were trying to put it all behind them. That was until autumn 2008. Dylan Ward was charged. The following month, Joe and Victor were also charged. Over 2 years had passed since the murder, but even then only conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and crime scene tampering charges were brought against the Swan Street Triple. On May 17th, 2010, a Washington, D.C. Superior Court trial got underway, and all three defendants were ultimately all acquitted in that bench trial on those pending charges. If you look through the affidavit, which is public record, it doesn't actually indicate who murdered Robert Wan, or even that the three men in particular were part of it. It simply accuses them of manipulating the crime scene, delaying calling the police, and that they were lying when investigators questioned them. I'll post a link in the episode description to the affidavit to save you a job searching for it. The trial, which started on June 2010, would last a week. It was a trial by judge, not a jury trial. Judge Lynn Leibovitz, who presided over their case, whilst not being able to order a guilty verdict, did state that the three men were, in her opinion, morally certain in their collective guilt. The family of Robert Wan have shifted their opinions of the three men in the years since the murder, and now absolutely suspect that the men had something to do with Robert's death.
The
trial begins tomorrow in a high-profile murder case that turned a DuPont Circle townhouse into the center of a mystery. Joseph Price, Victor Zaborski, and Dylan Ward are charged with obstruction of justice, not murder. Investigators believe the three men who lived in the house on Swan Street know who killed their housemate Robert Juan, but they have not told investigators. Juan was stabbed three times. The housemates say an intruder killed them.
Civil proceedings in a wrongful death suit were put forward by Robert's wife. But ultimately, the case was settled in August 2011 with an out-of-court settlement for an undisclosed sum and legal agreements. Now, 19 years later, and still very little seems clear about what happened that night and who is responsible for the murder of Robert Juan. A cloud of suspicion looms darkly over the Swan Street men, who continue to deny any involvement in the murder of their friend, and also in the alleged cover-up. After each of the men were found not guilty, they returned to Florida. Joseph Price changed his name to Joseph Anderson. Dylan Ward changed his name to Dylan Thomas. Joseph left his law firm and got a job with an immigrant advocacy group in Miami. Dylan became a Pilates instructor. Victor didn't change his name and continued working for the same marketing company that he had done before, where he remains today. Dylan would later end his relationship with Joe and Victor and has since married someone else. Joseph and Victor have split up and went their separate ways. So that means that all three of the former defendants are now living their own separate lives happily ever after, and no one has faced punishment or justice for the murder of Robert Juan. What do you think happened that night? Leave a comment below if you were on YouTube, or fire me a DM on Instagram if you're listening on a podcast platform. Let's discuss this case. Finally, if you haven't already, head over to our Patreon and sign up to join our growing community of supporters there. For just $2, you can get access to additional and exclusive episodes, blog posts, and early access to merch and product releases. Plus, you'll be giving us a huge helping hand. The link to our Patreon is in the episode description. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you all a massive amount to our Patreon supporters. We appreciate you more than we can explain. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.